Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 125 of the Chills at Will podcast. Extra cool. I'm talking to somebody who's probably, 15 miles away from me right now. Another Sacramentan in West Sac. And that is Jamil John Cochai. A little bit about him. He's the author of 99 Nights in Logar, which is right up my right shoulder here. Published by Viking in 2019. It was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award for Debut Novel and the DSC Prize for South Asian Literature. He was born in an Afghan refugee camp in Peshawar, Pakistan, but he originally hails from Logar, Afghanistan. His short stories and essays have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Plowshares, and the O. Henry Prize Stories 2018. Currently, he is a Stegner Fellow at Stanford University. Jamil, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you?
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm doing good.
So we were talking a little bit about, our Sacramento Kings. I say you're not necessarily a fan, which I appreciate. Yeah. the long-suffering Sacramento Kings fans. And, so you're a Bulls fan, you said.
That's right. Yeah. I've been a Bulls fan since 2008 when they drafted Derrick Rose. I was a big Derrick Rose fan. And he had that tragic injury and he ended up leaving the team. But I just sort of stuck with them since then. And I have to say I feel quite fortunate not to pick the Kings way back when they were super popular here in Sacramento.
Yeah. Good thing they didn't draft Luka. They could have had Luka, but we'll move on to the important stuff.
Okay, sounds good.
In a great book, which is, 99 Nights in Logar, one of the lines that kind of right off the bat, I was like, wow, and I want to know your inspiration for this. You referenced the dog, the wolf, the dog we'll talk about in a minute. You reference him having, his eyes were green like duck poo. So good. I can see that. I know exactly that color, right? What was it? I don't know if you can remember the inspiration for that particular imagery there.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. I actually can remember the exact, location. There's actually a pond right next to Southport Elementary School, which is first elementary school I attended when we moved out to West Sacramento. And we'd moved quite a bit from school to school, but I was at Southport for 2 years. And we had a duck pond and there was all these ducks and we'd go visit it all the time. And so quite familiar with the color of duck poo.
It's not the green of the shirt I'm wearing. It's a very distinct green.
That's right.
is Southport like the area of a lot of rice paddies and stuff in West Sac?
Yeah, that's right. We have the port of Sacramento has a rice factory, and so yeah. I think that we ship out quite a bit and produce quite a bit of rice here in West Sacramento, and I think that's actually one of our central industries.
West Sac, baby. So again, thanks so much for joining me, and it's been a pleasure reading through some of your more recent stuff, which will be in the collection coming out in July. And then 90 Nights in Logar, which, just finishing it today, and it's just swimming around in my head. I would love to know, just going back, talk about in the bio that you were born in the refugee camp in Peshawar, Pakistan. Looking at my map, is that, so Logar's in kind of northeast Afghanistan, is that safe?
That's right, yeah.
And so, how far is Peshawar from there? It seems like you maybe have some family connections as well. I think your grandfather maybe?
Yeah, that's right. My grandfather, he's buried in Peshawar, so we have we have long running roots to the city of Peshawar and that entire location, which for hundreds of years used to be a part of Afghanistan before we lost it to the Durand Line agreement, and it's It's fairly close, just in terms of like its actual like the geographical location. Mm-hmm. It's just it can be incredibly difficult to go back and forth, because it's such a mountainous terrain between Logar and Peshawar, and then at times it can be sort of dangerous depending on what's going on politically between both countries, but at the same time I would say that like the Logar and Peshawar for my family, it's like sort of the two central locations that they've moved back and forth between, and that sure. they sort of locate their history in.
Sure. I wonder, like your grandparents' generation and maybe your parents, do they consider themselves, you know, like they're more so into the region they're from, Logar, Afghan or Pashtun, you know, like are they, because of like the amorphous borders, if you will, right?
Yeah, that's something right.
Where it's like they identify more with the region, with the city, with the town. How does that work?
You know, it's funny. I think it's actually, I would say it's a bit of like all of the above. You know, mm-hmm. I think my father and my family as a whole were very proud to be Afghan and to mm-hmm. sort of belong to, you know, to Afghanistan. And you know, when they were doing great in cricket last year, it might have been 2 years ago, you know, we were rooting for them like crazy. And but at the same time, my father's very proud of the language he speaks. He's very proud of like Pashtun culture. And so there's that part of it as well. And then of course, like we're also very proud to be from Logar as well, which has its own unique culture and its own unique landscape and its own unique sort of flavor to it. And so, you know, it's funny because I would say that on different levels, like given the conversation, given the situation, you know, we're very bonded to all three of those sorts of forms of identity, right. I would say.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you. So I would love to know, you know, going back to the very beginning. So, I mean, was your route from Peshawar to Alabama to California, like in some of your writing? I mean, how early did you come to the States? I'd love to know about your relationship with language as well growing up, or languages.
Yeah, you know, I was born in Peshawar. I was there for only about like a year and a half, just because of like visa issues. My father was trying to get my mother and I out of the country. There were some issues with the documentation and what they were requesting, and so it all got delayed. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up being born in the refugee camp, and then a year and a half later, my father flew us, my mother and I both out to the Bay Area in California, actually. So when my father first got to the States in 82, they lived in Alabama. And then a couple of years later, they ended up moving to California. And so, but you know, I was lucky to just go straight to California, skipped over Alabama. So, you know, I grew up most of my life, almost entirely all of my life in California. The first couple of years was in the Bay Area. We lived in Hayward, California. And then there we moved up to West Sacramento when I was about 6 years old, I would say. And so, yeah, you know, I lived in an Afghan Pashtun household. My father was the only one, he wasn't the only one, but out of my parents, my father was the only one who really spoke English fairly well. Mm. And then, so I was growing up in a household with my mother and my grandmother and my aunts, and they spoke almost entirely Pashto. And so growing up, I spoke no English at all. And so when I entered elementary school for the first time, I was going in basically with zero knowledge of the English language. I don't know how, like, I didn't pick it up at all from television. I don't know if we just didn't, if it wasn't on in the house or what had happened. But I just remember, like, that's one of my distinct memories from when I was very young, just really struggling with the English language. And you know, there was a bit of like, you know, I'm not sure my kindergarten teacher handled it very well. And, you know, there was instances where I felt like sort of very left out because I couldn't speak English, and I struggled with it with a good deal. But, you know, I was very fortunate in that in second grade, I'd been having a ton of trouble with English. I'd gone back to Afghanistan, and the little that I'd learned when I came back, I'd completely forgotten. And so I was entering second grade, and I didn't know my alphabets. And so I was very behind. But I had this teacher at Alice Norman Elementary named Mrs. Lung. And she would sit with me every single day after school for like months and months, and basically like taught me the English language over the course of a year. Wow. And by the time I was in third grade, I was like winning awards for reading and stuff like that. Oh, man. And so I really like, I owe a lot to Mrs. Long. And, you know, as someone that's like, you know, I haven't seen her in years. I contacted her a few years ago over Facebook, and we had a very emotional phone call. But yeah, my father's he's still so grateful to Miss Lunk for what he did in that year.
Oh man, bless her, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the great things about 99 Nights are all the stories that are interspersed. You know, they're told by different characters. You know, the narrator, Marwand, right? Marwand is the narrator, but there are different stories throughout. Did you grow up in a culture or a specific household where stories were just stories and lore and history was huge? I mean, you know, another form of literature, of course, right? I mean,
yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that's actually one of the elements of like my upbringing that I found like, I was very, very fortunate in that I grew up with all these really incredible storytellers, you know, my mother and my father and my grandmother and even my aunts as well. Like they're fantastic storytellers. They could all like, you know, we would be sitting during dinner or while drinking tea or some, you know, out in the backyard or wherever it was, you know, during a long drive back and forth to the Bay Area and Sacramento. And all of a sudden they would fall into like this mesmerizing story of like their experience of the war or growing up in the countryside of Logar or journeying back and forth between Logar and Peshawar or arriving in Alabama for the first time or you know getting to California, driving across the country. And so yeah, you know, I was really inundated with like all of these stories. And like you mentioned, like, you know, some of them they're very rooted in history. They dealt with like the politics, the several you know, revolutions and coups that occurred in Afghanistan during their lifetime. Some of them were much more rooted in like folklore and these sort of, you know, these Afghan folk tales that they'd grown up with. And then of course also, you know, like the Quran and the Hadith also like played a large role in our household as well. And so I was sort of inundated with stories from the Quran, from the Hadith, from Afghan history, from folk tales, from their personal experiences of America. And I really owe a lot to that, I think, to how that sort of how that shaped my own vision of storytelling as a writer.
Definitely. Yeah. What were you reading then? You know, third grade, you got those, you know, I remember, I think you're a little bit younger, but you know, you get the little stamps at the library or the school, or you get tickets to the A's game, or, you know, there's, you get, yeah, you know, totally. You're right. You know, fourth grade, of course,
pizza party.
Yeah. Pizza party, all those kind of things. What was it that you were reading that really thrilled you from a young age?
Well, and I think this pretty like consistent with much of my particular generation. For me, it was Harry Potter. Like I picked up my first Harry Potter book. I think it was actually third grade. Like as soon as I figured out how to read the English language, and then I got to Harry Potter, and I was just absolutely enthralled by those books. You know, I devoured them. I'd finished at the time only four had been released, I think four or five, and I ended up finishing all five of those books within like a year or something like that. My parents were just like, they were just astonished by the fact that I was just like in my little corner in our living room just like plowing through these gigantic books when I couldn't even like couldn't even write my alphabets like a year ago. And so yeah, Harry Potter was what really got me into reading and really like fiction as an art form and as an experience. I owe a lot to those books.
Was fiction like that, you know, which I guess kind of fantasy, I mean, was that like an escape of sorts or just like, man, this is cool? Like
You know, I'm not sure how much of it like necessarily like an escape. I do remember vividly like just being absolutely enthralled by the experience of like opening up a book and like then beginning reading and just entering a new world. I remember talking about this with one of my friends like just a couple of weeks ago, but like what I loved most about Harry Potter even more so than like the characters and the adventures and the magic, was like Hogwarts itself, like as an institution and as a location, like watching them like roam those halls and discovering the, you know, these different chambers in the castle, and even just going from, you know, class to class, and going up and sleeping in their little chambers that they had together. That was absolutely like mesmerizing and enthralling for me. And so it's funny to say it's a book about wizards, but actually reading that text and experiencing that world, for me it felt like this magical, like sort of like indescribable experience. And so, you know, as a kid, I just remembered, like, I just couldn't get enough of that. And I was just like, well, how can I get more of this? For me, I remember, like, it was just such a different experience than watching films, I think, you know, which I loved movies growing up, but it's like, I think in some ways, watching film can be very a passive experience. You're just sort of watching the movie do what it wants to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, reading, it felt like there was something about it that felt like, you know, I was a part of this thing, and I was doing this work to imagine this world and be a part of this world. And I remember I just really, really loving that.
Thank you for making the case, right? The book is always better than the movie, right?
That's right.
Always.
I would say so.
Maybe the Godfather, but besides that, you know,
definitely. Yeah, that's a good example.
I wanted to ask you kind of about like your generation or generations. And you were talking about books and movies. I'm thinking of like one of the parts that was so interesting to me from like The Kite Runner, right? Khaled Hosseini, was he talked about how in Afghanistan, it was expected that you would give away the ending, that you would spoil the ending. That's the way he writes about it in the book, right?
So
he was talking about like in the States, you know, the character, you know, he would say, oh, you know, this is how the movie ends, and spoiler alert, or whatever they say back in the day.
That's true. I would agree with that.
I thought that was so interesting. But I guess, and I wanted to kind of transition into like Khaled Hosseini and generations. Like, were you the generation that was reading like knew about that book when you were a teenager? And then also the fact that you know, you said your dad came in 82.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Sacramento in recent years especially have a lot, you know, of Afghans coming here. I just wonder how that, like, were you one of the few families like of that generation, you know, like the earlier generation, or how kind of the Afghan population in Sacramento?
Well, you know, I'll talk about Khaled Hosseini first. Yeah. You know, I would say that you know, the Kite Runner, it was a big deal. And I think in a lot of ways, like, I owe a lot to that book, just in terms of the fact that, like, it was the first time that I read about Afghanistan, like in a novel, in this sort of like, you know, fictionalized form. And so in that way, like, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure I would have became a writer if I hadn't read the Kite Runner for the first time. Mm-hmm. That being said, I will say that, like, you know, I read that book for the first time, I think I was like 13 years old. It'd been a couple of years since the book had been out. And, it was this massive, you know, national phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Everyone that I met would be like, as soon as I told them they're Afghan, they'd be like, oh, have you read the Kite Runner? I love the Kite Runner.
Right.
And so I entered that book, I think, with like really high expectations. And I remember like having this really profound sense of disappointment with it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I thought, the depiction of the country was very odd to me, and the, you know, I had some issues with some of how the characterization was laid out, and in years later I would go on to have sort of some more like minute issues and the complex issues with that, the political representation in the novel, and so some of the ideological issues I think I would go on to have with the novel. But in a lot of ways, you know, to be quite frank, like, I just didn't think his depiction of Afghanistan was beautiful enough. And I think I came away with that from that book, just not entirely impressed with his talent as a writer. And so, and this is in stark contrast to like, for example, 100 Years of Solitude, which I would read a few years later, and which, you know, and the first time I picked up 100 Years of Solitude, the language and the imagery and the vision of that little village in Colombia, it was so mesmerizing for me. It was so beautiful. It was so haunting. It was so tragic. I saw so much of my own experience of Afghanistan in those characters that, like, it's very funny because they're such different books, and, you know, Colombia, of course, is very different from Afghanistan. But at the same time, like, I think I went into the Kite Runner sort of expecting that. Yeah. And, you know, when that didn't happen, it was very vividly disappointing for me. And I think in a lot of ways, to be honest, like, when I finished that book, I thought for the first time, like, you know, that can't be it, like, for Afghanistan. And in a lot of ways, unfortunately, even since then, like, The Kite Runner is sort of the Afghan book. Like, it's what everyone references when they talk about Afghanistan. And I was like, I felt like inspired at that moment when I finished that book. I was like, I have to be able to do something better than that. And I think in a lot of ways, so I owe that, you know, if nothing else, I owe the Kite Runner just sort of the motivation to write something, I think, better than the Kite Runner. And which is not to say that my work is stronger than the Kite Runner, but I would say that it's certainly doing different things in terms of, like, what the literature it's engaging with and what it's trying to accomplish artistically. And so I owe a lot to the Kite Runner, but that initial reading experience was disappointing, I'll say.
Well, my long question stimulated a long answer, so it worked out well. So I guess that kind of also speaks to the fact too, like, are you, and we're in 2022 and, you know, representation is on everyone's lips, or should be, or it should have been 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 70 years ago. Do you feel like sometimes that you are expected to, like, be everything for everyone, like that you're supposed to, like, have the complete, the, you know, like, singular, like, Afghan experience or Afghan American experience? Do you ever feel like undue pressure, I guess?
You know, I would say a little bit, you know, I think, but I would say that I think much of that pressure is, it's sort of, it's in many ways, it's like internal. Mm-hmm. And so when I was going into writing the novel, and when I began to realize, you know, once I'd gotten the agent, and once I'd gotten sort of into the process of, like, oh, you know, like, publishers are actually interested in the book, and, you know, it's actually going to be, you know, it's going to be sold, and it's going to be on Amazon and all these different things. Like the weight of what I was doing began to sort of, like, you know, I began to feel that very profoundly, I would say. And, you know, and I began to understand that there was sort of this, I don't know, I think I just, like, I began to see, or I began to feel like the sort of responsibility that I had to make sure that, you know, if I was writing this book about Afghanistan, and that if this book was then going to be largely consumed by, like, this white American reading audience, that I did have sort of this responsibility to make sure that, like, I did the country justice, not the country necessarily, but at least, you know, this village in Logar, you're right, that I did that place justice, that I depicted it in a complex, in a complicated, in a layered, and ultimately, like, in a beautiful way. And so, you know, I did sort of feel that pressure, I would say, was definitely there all throughout the writing, but not so much. I did, you know, think there were certain elements of, like, marketing the book where it did feel a little bit like, you know, that this is the next novel about Afghanistan, whereas, you know, I think it can be much simpler than that. Like, this is, it is certainly in many respects, it is a novel about Afghanistan and the history of Afghanistan, but it's also, you know, it's also just a book about a boy and his summer in a village, you know, in his parents' home village. And so I was trying to balance that both out while I was writing and sort of contending with its publication.
Right. Yeah. So you felt it internally maybe more than anything else.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah.
I wondered, you know, just about, like, you know, like, the white gaze, like, I mean, the second and third last page is all in, I assume, Pashto.
That's right.
Right. There are a lot of words that are not, you know, translated. Right. In probably Farsi, Pashto, all the above, Arabic, maybe even some. Right.
That's right. Yeah.
There's very little talk of America. One of the things I really loved about the book, too, is just like you said, this is his summer. These are his 99 days.
Yeah.
And I don't know that much about him in America, and I feel like that was a good thing. Like, yeah. Right? I mean, Marwan really just, like, he was there. And
yeah.
I mean, there are the points exactly where right. he struggles with language, right, at times. Mm-hmm. But he obviously is able to get, you know, get himself understood. And he's
right.
a native of Lagar, more or less, for those 99 days, right?
That's right, yeah.
So I just wonder about, you know, I mean, I guess the obvious answer is you about why you didn't translate Psalms, because, you know, that's is keeping it authentic and genuine. I guess just wonder about, like, the white gaze and maybe, like, you know, people who are not Afghan and maybe what feedback they gave and which and what mattered to you.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. You know, I would say that, like, certainly, like, these issues of, like, contending with the white gaze and trying to resist, like, pandering to mm-hmm. a white audience, like, that was certainly there from the very beginning, from the outset of the book. But I will say that, like, you know, at the same time, some of those decisions that I made in terms of, like, not translating terminology mm-hmm. or leaving that, you know, the second to last chapter entirely in Pashto, like, mm-hmm. that came out more so from an issue of craft than it did
okay.
Like political or like socio-political concerns, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when I was coming up with Marwan's voice, it was very important to me that the voice felt natural to his experience, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm writing this Afghan American narrator. I want him to be immersed in his experience of yeah. Logar. And yeah. so it just made sense to me that, like, you know, he wasn't going to be translating terminology for right. you know, the his reading audience. He wasn't, he was going to be switching back and forth between languages like he would do at home or in the village or with his family members, right? Like, it was, you know, one of the very early, one of the very early pieces of writing advice that I remember reading was, you know, I think it was Kurt Vonnegut who said, you know, write everything to someone you love, and you know, to like a single person, right? And so I think in a lot of ways I was trying to capture that sense that, like, this yeah. I wanted to write this book to like a family member or a dear friend. And so, you know, if I'm writing to a dear friend, like, I'm not going to be, like, explaining all this terminology sure. and translating things into this. I'm just going to be rolling with the story. I'm going to ask them to take my hand and just sort of run with me throughout the narrative. And so when it came to sort of those elements of not translating it, like, you know, again, you know, certainly that, like, the political issues are a part of it, but initially they started out more as craft concerns than anything else. And okay. so, you know, the response has been, largely the response has been very positive. You know, I think, you know, when whether it's my editors or my agent or, you know, the reviewers, largely the response has been good. There are, you know, the occasional readers and reviewers, especially on Goodreads or on Amazon, who had big issues with the fact that things weren't translated. And they felt like, you know, that the novel was sort of, that the novel had ripped them off because they didn't get that second to last chapter. They felt like they were being excluded from the story. They felt like the novel needed a glossary in order for them to really engage with it. And so, I can't like sort of deny their concerns, but at the same time, like, I can say with certain that my intention wasn't to exclude any of my readership. You know, the decisions that I made, like, it was very, very difficult to come to that decision to make that second to last chapter in Pashto. Like, I understood the what I was asking my editors to go along with when I was like, the second to last, I'm not going to translate the second to last mm-hmm. chapter. And so, but it felt like at the time that's how it had to be mm-hmm. for the sake of the story, and not necessarily because of, like, you know, what I was trying to accomplish with the novel politically or ideologically or anything like that. But that's what the novel needed to happen. And so, and I felt like I needed to be brave enough to just let it be and stay in that language.
I love that when writers talk about the story as if it's like personify it, you know, that's what the story demanded.
Yeah. The story is no, so demanding. It's an odd thing, but I swear it's something that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see the second chapter any differently now, you know. Just we don't need to know everything. We, you know, the reader doesn't need to know everything. A lot of times there's the idea of there's more truth or significance in what's not being said than what is said. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. And so for those who do read it and understand it, there's a different, you know, strength there. And for those who don't, there's a strength there. Going back a little bit, you know, I would put Marquez in my top three or four.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Oh man, is it Arakataka? Is that his?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's been too long since I've read and taught it in my classes even, but I'm embarrassed to say I've read some, but not all of 100 Years of Solitude. I'm a huge fan of his short stories. For me, are where it's at.
Oh, I love his short stories.
Oh man. So I would love to know, you know, him and others who, as you got into high school, college, who, you know, maybe more contemporary writers, who are the ones who really gave you the title of the podcast, you know, the chills at will, the thrills.
Yeah. You know, certainly Marquez was a huge influence. I remember finishing that novel for the first time and just being left absolutely like astounded by what like I had just experienced, you know, and I was like, and I think ever since then, like everything that I try to do with my own writing is it's sort of written in the shadow of that experience of trying to accomplish something just barely resembling what I ended up experiencing when I finished 100 Years of Solitude for the first time. But you know, throughout high school, you know, I really loved, I didn't do well pretty much in all of my classes except my English classes. And and I really loved some of the novels that we were tasked to read during those courses. They were really important to me. You know, I remember reading 1984 for the first time. Oh, yeah. And you know, sort of like, I think like that was like a awakening for me in terms of like my political consciousness and like looking at this dystopian world and how much it seemed to resemble like present day America. And that was like really a horrifying experience for me.
Yeah,
and I became like attuned to like surveillance for the first time. And I was like, oh, wow, like I'm being like watched like all the time. And that was really unnerving for me. Richard Wright's novel, Native Son, that was huge for me as well. Like I remember finishing that novel and just feeling absolutely shattered by what I just read, you know, the complexity of that novel, the way that it was engaging with race in America, like that was profoundly important for me as well. And then, you know, I didn't read Beloved until like, I think it was my first year of college, but that was another novel that like, when I read Beloved for the first time and seeing, you know, not just in terms of like the story itself, like the narrative it's absolutely, you know, heartrending, but the form as well, like what she was doing in terms of form, in terms of moving between different character consciousness and the way what she was doing with the text itself and the way that the story, like it falls into poetry at different moments. And that was also profoundly important. So I'd say those are some of the novels that have just, that they have like they've marked my heart. Yeah. I would say.
Oh, that's a heck of a list. That's a heck of a list. That iconic first line from 100 Years of Solitude is, unless you can quote it, I'm going to quote it. Can you quote it?
It's many, many years later, Colonel Aliano Buendia will, many years later, as he's standing before the firing squad, Colonel Aliano Buendia will think back to the moment his father took him to discover ice. Like I butchered it, but it's something like that.
So here it is. You're right on. Quote, many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Ariano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice.
Whew. Love it. Oh my God.
Man. Well, you know, the story goes that he supposedly was like on a vacation. He like had the idea and turned the car around and wrote in like a blistering, you know, 48, 72 hours. But I think that's been debunked, but that's a cool story to think about that he wrote that book.
I read about that too. And I think like he, you know, his, I think he like stopped working for a while and like his wife had to like take on extra shifts and she had like took on like all the household and then, and then she just let him write. And, you know, I just can't like that. That's, you know, having that sort of a partner in your corner. Like, that's
I think something too, like she later like logged the amount of cigarettes she bought him or something like that too. And it was just like off the, you know, off the charts.
Yeah.
Well, so here's a cool transition. I was absolutely honored to speak to Jess Walter.
And his, that's so cool.
His first line from Beautiful Ruins, he said it was heavily based on Buendia on the great line here. And he and I know recently shouted out your short story.
Yeah, Jess is, you know, he was one of my instructors at the IO Writers Workshop. Oh, okay. And we would play basketball every week.
He can hoop.
He can really hoop. Like he's, you know, he's he used to play high school ball, and yeah, I think he might have played a little bit of college ball, but yeah, he can play ball. Like I've played basketball my entire life, and I've played with some really good ball players, but Jess is good. And so, you know, we really, you know, we bonded in the classroom, but it was really on the court developed the friendship. He was actually he was out here in Sacramento a couple of weeks ago.
That's
and
right.
We went to one of the hoops in downtown, and we played some one-on-one, and yeah, so Jess has been really, really incredibly supportive of my work ever since we met. And so so it's been that, you know, he's tremendously talented, and so it's been really great to have him in my corner as sort of as a mentor and as someone I can sort of go to with you know, when I'm grappling with sort of the questions of my own novel. And he's such a fantastic novelist that he always has really brilliant advice off.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I go back and reread Beautiful Runes every, you know, 2 years or so.
Right.
And you know, I mean, there's a movie within that book that's trying to be made. Like, I mean, that book would be an incredible movie. Beautiful Runes would, you know.
He's a fantastic writer.
Oh man. So what's your game? Are you like a drive to the hoop? Are you like a shooter? Like,
yeah, no, that's and it's unfortunate because I'm losing a step now as I'm entering my 30s.
Come on, it's in your 30s, man. I'm 42, man. Come on.
I mean, you know, the back in the day, you know, when I was younger, I used to be able to touch that rim, and now I can barely get to the net. And so yeah, that was my game. I grew up, I was absolutely in love with Allen Iverson. My whole game was just crossover and try to get to the rack. And so you know, I never practiced. I kind of wish I'd grown up in the Curry era, because I feel like I would have been practicing my jump shot more, and that would have been more helpful as I'm sort of losing my top end speed here. But you know, I can still get to the hoop a little bit.
Nice.
Yeah.
There's no confidence in the world like being able to get to the hoop whenever you want. It's been a while for me. One of your quotes is, "But whenever I approach a story from some new absurd dimension, it's always with the goal of understanding the characters on another level or of learning something new about the family as a whole."
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did you, this is a long way of getting there, I guess, but I mean, how did you get to that mindset? What were some of the in-between steps, you know, where you became a thinking writer? Like, you know, what were you writing in the early days? Just kind of like, oh, this is fun. Or maybe you were working on a deep novel when you're 8 years old. I don't know. But, you know, what were you working on in high school and college that got you with the writing bug? I know you talked about what you read that made you want to do it, and I get that. But what were kind of like maybe some eureka moments where it was like, I can do this and I can do this well?
You know, I remember I started writing seriously, I think, during like semi-seriously. I became sort of fascinated by it in high school when my English teacher, Miss Goldman at River City High, she almost forced me into this creative writing class because she'd really loved some of the essays I'd submitted. And so I'm taking this creative writing class. And I'm writing, you know, fiction and submitting it for the first time and reading it aloud and you know, or I'm sharing it with other people for the first time, and I'm really loving it. And I remember you know, I wrote this one story. My fiction in the beginning, I think it was very realist, right? Like I wrote this one story about a guy getting executed by firing squad. And then I wrote this other story.
The Buendia connection.
Exactly. Yeah. He's there, right? He's been there since the beginning. And, you know, I wrote this other story about like a hunter going after a deer or something like that. It was very realist fiction.
Yeah.
And that stuck with me for a while because, you know, even though I was reading magical realism, like for some reason, I couldn't get there, I think, with my fiction in the beginning. And then I was reading a lot of, in college, I was reading a lot of Hemingway and Faulkner and Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, okay.
And I remember writing these stories that were like, they're just basically like imitations of Hemingway and McCarthy. And these like, it was basically me like just writing this sort of like neo-biblical sort of very old white guy sort of a voice. Huh. It was very bad, but it was important that I got through that stage because eventually I got to this place. I'm pretty I think it was important that I began pretty firmly rooted in realism and just sort of gradually made my way to like more like engaging more with like absurdism and magical realism and surrealism and these other like literary forms that are sort of going away, sort of dabbling with what's real and not real and how you can. And so in sort of in the later years of my undergrad, and then once I was starting a grad school, that's when I'm reading like more of Borges, and I'm reading more of Italo Calvino, and I'm reading more of Kafka, and I'm revisiting Marquez, and I'm seeing the different ways that like that writing something that's in a certain sense like unreal, right? Like a guy waking up and he's a cockroach, right? How that can lead you to actually like a more accurate depiction or more accurate, an in-depth reading of that character. And once that began to sort of click in my head, that like when you're using like unreality or magic or surreality to get at something even realer in the character, like that's when sort of a light bulb went off in my head.
I
And
see.
that's when I think I started approaching fiction in this different way. And so, I still write realist fiction. I still start like my thing is like I always want to start with character. But if my character and if the story can be helped along by doing something like, the going into a video game, for example, and all of a sudden your family members are in a video game, or if one of the characters turns into a monkey, and then that leads them on an adventure back to Afghanistan, or if or if something else in that respect happens, something magical, something unreal, if it's serving story and if it's serving the characters, that's when I'm like, okay, this is really working.
I'm being a bad Italian. I have not read Calvino. Well, give me a rec. What was one short piece or book?
Oh, Calvino. Okay, so he's got a story, short story. I'm just looking if I've got it somewhere up on my shelf here. But the story that really stuck with me, it has a funny name. It's like Q7VCR. It's about like this. It's about like this cell in a universe. Like beginning to take up space for the first time. So it's very scientific, and it's about I think it's like the elements of stars or something, and they're like entering existence for the first time, and they're developing, and then they're falling in love with one another, and then they're having all this drama, and then he's got this other story where a guy is falling in love with someone on the moon, and he's just trying to get to the moon. And so it's this funny story. And it's like, it's in a lot of ways it's surreal and it's magical. But at the same time, like when you look at the writing and when you look at what he's trying to like get at in terms of like this character's desire, it all sort of comes to like it becomes like this more honest and accurate depiction
I see.
of how much love this character felt for another character. And so that like not like re reality can't contain it anymore, and it has to go somewhere else. And so I love that.
I have an idea for like a pitch of like an article or an essay about going back, I guess it'd be almost 20 years now, and reading The Metamorphosis again.
That's lovely. I love the
Because
Metamorphosis.
I'm obviously great minds like yourself have said, I just thought it was too on the nose. I don't
Oh, wow.
know.
Cool.
I
No,
just, you know, so,
that's fair.
you know,
That's
I
fair.
was probably like a 20-year-old college junior or something like that. So I got, you know, I'll go back to it. I would love to talk with someone about Borges on one particular story. Have you read The Gospel According to Mark?
The gospel. I'm sure. Do you know which collection that's from? Is it from Ficciones?
I think so. I feel like I just read it in like a best of, or you know, so like it
I'm
wasn't.
sh I'm sure I've read the story. Could you
Just
describe the plot a little bit?
knock my socks off. So this is the one where there's this, you know, I think a lot of it is specific to Argentina of that time, but like it's kind of like a, you know, like true like bourgeoisie kind of like college student. You might call him like a hipster nowadays. You know, he's from the big city and he's kind of like trying to like get an experience. And so he lives with his family, like rural poor family, like in the summer maybe. And you know, he teaches them to read, and they're just like, oh man. So you know, he's like their first teacher. it's like an illiterate family. They're illiterate in English and Spanish. They have English ancestors from way back, and he teaches them to read. And so, you know, they're just eating up everything he gives them. And then he teaches them to read the Bible. And it's this idea of, like, you know, taking something so literally, they take his readings of the Bible so literally that, turn this off if you're listening and you're about to read the story, that he wakes up one morning and they have a wooden cross ready to go to crucify him.
I haven't read this story. This sounds fantastic.
It's, I mean, you with the O. Henry stories, I mean, it was just like, whoa, you know, just that twist at the end. So anyways.
Oh, that's lovely.
Sorry to like talk you through it rather than have you read it, but
I'm going to recommend it.
I didn't do it justice either.
I'm going to read that like literally as soon as they finish the podcast. So good, that sounds so good. Fantastic.
So good. 99 Nights in Logar, the epigraphs are Franz Fanon. It's about speaking a language and which allows you to inhabit the world. It's in French, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. I have a big poster of Fanon in my classroom, this whole idea, you know, of the...
Oh, that's so lovely.
I want to say double speak, but that's 1984. This double consciousness. What's that term when you have two competing ideas in your mind and you have to... it's an easy one that I can't think of, but... Fanon obviously is unbelievable, and I know very little of him. I know he had a lot to say about colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering about that epigraphing. Then you have Kipling, quote unquote, unaccountable as a gray wolf, who is his blood brother. It's part of that. I'm a huge epigraph fan. I talked with Jess about his awesome one from like Life magazine that starts Beautiful Ruins, about Richard Burton or something like that being a beautiful ruin to describe a person like that. Anyways, I love epigraphs. I'd love to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah. You know, Franz Fanon, I would say similarly, like he's a theorist who I think I'm in love with Franz Fanon's work. His work has been really influential to me. Someone that I've come back to repeatedly, you know, throughout my writing, just when I'm thinking about the history of Afghanistan and the, you know, the 100 years of colonization that's occurred there. Like, it's been very helpful for me in terms of like understanding what has happened and what's even currently ongoing in Afghanistan, you know, through his sort of his analysis of colonization in Algeria. And then back home where he grew up in the Caribbean, and so you know, for me, that quotation in particular, like, that was a really important moment for me, because like it rang so true to me in terms of, you know, it's something like you know, that every language contains its own universe, its own world, right? And for me, like, when I'm engaging with Pashto, right, and it's unfortunate because in many ways, like, Pashto, it's a dying language. It's you know, there's less and less speakers, although it has this really wonderful lineage of like poetry and folk tales and these sorts of things, like there's not a lot of there's not a lot of literature coming out of the Pashto, or at least literature that can be easily accessed by the rest of the world. And so, and you know, and that partly has to do with the fact of, like, you know, that the Pashtun people have been dealing with colonization, with imperialism, and with different varying forms of warfare for hundreds of years now, right? And so for me, like, when I was thinking through what I wanted to accomplish with 99 Nights in Logar, and the ways that, like, Marwan as a narrator is switching between English and Farsi and Arabic and Pashto, like, it was coming back to the idea that each one of these languages is its own world, and that, like, you know, when you lose a language, you're losing like an entire universe of stories. And so, you know, when I was thinking through, like, what I wanted to accomplish with this novel, and what Pashto means to me as an English writer, right, as someone who grew up speaking Pashto and understanding the world first of all through Pashto, and then sort of gradually losing that a bit as I became more and more in tune to English, like, that's one of the most important elements of the novel that I wanted to engage with. And so, and I think that was sort of encapsulated by Fanon's quote. And then with Kipling, of course, that's more straightforward, and that's from a story called The Emir's Homily, and it's about this this Englishman meeting with the King Emir Abdurrahman for the first time. I think it's either in Peshawar or it's in Kabul, and it begins with a description of Afghans, and it's something like the Afghan. It's not a very positive depiction. It's basically like the Afghan. He's very violent. He's very cunning. He can be very, you know, he's very good with the sword. But when he needs to, he will run away and cower. And it's basically like, and it comes down to like that. It's description of the Afghan as a wolf. Like that's sort of his the ending metaphor in the beginning of this story. And for me, you know, that was a really important. And it's good that I came to that story like later in my life, and I've become sort of attuned to, like, you know, to the varying representations of Afghans in Afghanistan. Yeah. But I think that's actually like it's a depiction that continues to like be sort of one of the more you know, foundational associations. It's this idea that the Afghan is like primordially violent, that the Afghan is like foundationally, fundamentally violent, and that there's something inside the Afghan that's like essentially savage or violent or something like that. And so, you know, he compares the Afghan to the wolf. And so I think, you know, when I was thinking through like the character of Budabash, and I was thinking about like the way that this novel was engaging with violence and then also with like representation, like a lot of what I was both trying to engage with and what I was trying to resist is sort of rooted in that story. It's an exploration of violence and savagery and warfare and how much that can all be resisted through like these different elements of, I don't know, storytelling and family and these different bonds that can occur within a small village in Afghanistan.
Wow, thank you. I was hoping you weren't just gonna say like, oh, I had to do something last minute and I just found this. Budabash is a dog, a wolf, kind of in between, right? How much is Budabash a real creature, and how much is Budabash a representation, allegorical, a symbol?
Budabash, you know, started out as being very real. Like, you know, we actually had a guard dog named Budabash in our home village in Afghanistan in my mother's family's compound. And just like in the novel, he was this absolutely like terrifying, vicious dog. But also deeply, deeply loyal to his own family, right? So like he was very protective of like my mother's family in Afghanistan, and he absolutely hated me. As soon as I got there, I tried to make friends with him and he wasn't having it at all, like viciously barked at me and would just never let me get near him. And so, and one day he, you know, of course he breaks out of this like 10-foot heavy iron chain, jumps over like this 15-foot clay wall in our compound. And he actually went out into the village, and we went after him. And that's sort of like the beginning of the story itself. Yeah. But of course, you know, as I'm writing the novel, and as, you know, as Budabash is becoming more and more intrinsic to like the momentum of the novel itself, you know, he's the main character's main antagonist, but he's also the main character's central desire. It's what the entire novel story revolving around and going after. Like as the novel is progressing, I think like my conception of Budabash, it begins to change, right? And he becomes less and less of like this physical animal. And more and more, as you mentioned, like he becomes more and more metaphorical. He becomes more and more allegorical. And as much as possible, like as I was writing the novel, I tried to like make sure that was occurring naturally, and that I wasn't going in and trying to like, you know, implement, you know, or sort of infect the novel with symbolism or whatever else I wanted to do. But I really wanted Budabash to sort of organically become something larger than what he initially was in the beginning of the novel.
You pulled it off. That's for dang sure. Yes.
Thank you.
Marwan is an American, like we talked about earlier. I mean, he's Afghan American, but you know, we talked about earlier, he's there for the summer. He's there for the 99 days. He ingratiates himself, you know, right away, you know, for the most part. Early on in the book, I think it was referring to him as help me if I'm pronouncing it, Musafir as an Musafir as a traveler, right?
Musafir, yeah.
I wonder how much you were kind of trying to infuse his character with being a traveler, with being there for a short time. You know, the close to the end, it ends obviously with them leaving, with the family leaving.
That's going right, back yeah. to the States.
How much of it was just kind of like, not like a vignette, because obviously it was over a long period of time, but how much of it was just like kind of like a slice of life, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, I mean, you know, I think that's exactly what I was trying to get at with Marwan's character, is that it is sort of this idea that he's a wanderer, he's a traveler, mm-hmm. You know, not just in the sense that he's coming to visit this country and he's going to be there for a short amount of time, but also in the fact that, like, the main sort of momentum of the novel, it's a journey, right? It's this character going out on the road and getting lost and searching for you know, Buddha Bosch, but also, you know, something else, something a little bit deeper, more complex than that. And so, you know, this idea of Marwan being a musafir, a traveler, a wanderer, it was really, I think, essential to his character. And then, of course, you know, because he's the narrator, it sort of becomes essential to, like, the shape and the momentum of the novel as a whole.
Right. I mean, and he's an observer. I mean, there's even one time where he's, you know, they're using the burqa. So, I mean, he's going around, right, you know, for a pretty long period of time. And I mean, he's literally just, you know, watching. He was trying to take pictures and the whole deal.
That's exactly right.
How much do you feel like he was like an active participant in the story, and how much did you want it to be about him, like, seeing things through his eyes?
That was actually, you know, it's funny you say that, because that was sort of one of the central conflicts of, like, my actual writing of the novel, right? Like, you know, when I was learning or taking, like, when I was becoming a student of fiction writing for the first time, everything was about making sure your character maintains a certain level of agency, right? Mm. Get your character into trouble, force your character to make choices that they don't want to make, mm-hmm. and then see what happens, and how does that change the character, and how does that change the relationships within the story, and so, you know, so much of it, you know, when I'm starting out writing, everything was about making sure the characters aren't passive and making sure there's as much agency there as mm-hmm. possible, because that's how you get a story going. That's momentum. It makes the character more complex. And so, you know, starting off, that's exactly what I wanted to happen. You know, I wanted Mark to go off out on this chase. I wanted him getting into trouble. I wanted him doing things. I wanted him acting. I wanted him making mistakes. But, you know, it got to a point in the novel where, you know, when Marwan gets stuck in the middle of the village for the first time and the group has been separated, it got to this point where, like, I didn't know what to do next. Like, I was like, oh, I've, like, you know, I've mm-hmm. created so many conflicts, I've jammed my character up, and I'm like, mm-hmm. where do I go now? And so it was this period of time where, like for months, you know, I didn't write a word. It was absolutely horrifying to me, because I felt like I had such momentum with this novel. Yeah. I was going to submit it as my graduate thesis project, and I was, like, so excited, and then I just couldn't write. I was like, I didn't know what to do next. And then, you know, it got to this point where I had to become more I had to become more comfortable with the idea of Marwan becoming a passive character, and I began to allow other characters to enter into the story and to sort of carry Marwan along, or else to allow Marwan to just sit back and either observe the story occurring around him, or to listen to another story. And that's when sort of the idea of the story within the story became mm-hmm. really crucial to the novel, because that's when, like, I sort of, my perspective on the novel shifted, and it became less so about making Marwan do things and acting and agency, and it became more so about Marwan searching for the next story. And so whether that's mm-hmm. you know, listening to someone tell a story about their life, or observing the world around him, I had to become more comfortable with this idea of turning Marwan into more of a passive character, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of this balancing act. Like, I didn't want him to become entirely passive. I still wanted him making mistakes. I still wanted him acting. I still wanted him doing all these things. But at the same time, I also, like, this idea of him becoming an observer like that's also something that I think becomes more and more prominent as the novel goes on.
Yeah, definitely. The stories you talk about that are interspersed throughout the narration, you know, early on the grandmother tells an old tale that basically the point is like family, you know, blood is thicker in the water, you know, those type of
things. That's right. Yeah.
We talk, you know, the last story that's in Pashto is, I believe, right about, now is it pronounced Agha?
Agha.
Right? About his brother. So this is Marwan's uncle. Marwan's dad and his brother who was killed, and he was throughout the book. I mean ghosts are literal and figurative, you know, figuratively throughout the book. And it's not till that second to last chapter where he tells the story. But you know, it's just so interesting and so sad as you think about his brother throughout, and they get to points where they're about to tell what happened, or you don't know who knows what. And that's again why what made it so successful at the end is just like the father gets it off his chest in so many ways, and he tells it his own way.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. How about the thief? The thief was an interesting character to me. He was also maybe wearing a burqa.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Like all the time or just part of the time? I mean, he was...
Part of the time, yeah.
He was just clever and you know, just an absolute trickster.
Yeah.
How would you define his role in the book?
Well, you know, the thief is, I'm happy you mentioned him because he's like one of my favorite characters in the novel. He was actually like, when I was in Logar in 2012, I was at my cousin's house and we were all eating dinner together and they began telling the story of this guy named Jawed, and they called him Jawed the thief. Like that was his name. Mm. And they were telling me the story about this guy who had been pretending to be a talib, but was working with the soldiers all along. But at the same time, he was also using the soldiers' intel and sort of selling that back to the Taliban, and was like stealing weaponry. And so he was playing both sides against one another. Yes, he was a talib and he was a soldier, and he was off in the village, but primarily he was a thief. Like that was his main occupation. Yeah. And so both the Taliban, and so they're telling me about this guy who like the Taliban were also chasing after him, and like the government forces and the Americans were also after him. And so he was like, for me, like this really fascinating character. And what I loved about Jawed in particular is that he really like he broke down for me sort of this black and white depiction of the war, that it was like strictly these Taliban, you know, against the government and the Americans. And here was the good guys and here was the bad guys. And that there's the strict line, and that this is how the war, we just needed to smash the Taliban, and that was how the war was going to end. But, you know, the more and more that like I became, you know, the more and more that I learned about Logar, the more and more time that I spent there, the more and more research I did about the war, the more like I learned like that, like it's actually, there's much more gray area than there is black and white. Like there are families who, you know, one brother will become a talib and the next brother will become a soldier. And there are all these people who, you know, they started off as soldiers and then they would switch to the Taliban, or they're a Taliban, they would, you know, leave the Taliban and they'll become soldiers. And then, or there were Taliban who would purposely for years pretend to be a soldier and then one day do like an insider attack. And so, and they're also like government figures who are secretly selling weaponry to the Taliban because everything was about their own end in the end, right? And so the more and more that like I became like, you know, that it became a familiar with this war, the more so it became clear to me that there was a lot more fluidity in terms of like how the actual war was being fought than is depicted, I think, in national media and most conceptions of the war in Afghanistan. And I think that, you know, that ends up showing with the eventual collapse of the of the Afghan government in Kabul. And so, you know, so that was, so with Jawed, sorry, to get back to Jawed. Sure. So with Jawed in particular, like he was an important character for me because I really wanted him to sort of represent this sense of the fluidity of the war. When, mm-hmm. you know, when initially he enters the story, they think he's a Talib. Later on, there's like all these rumors that he's actually, you know, he's like a spy with the government. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they say, you know, he's actually, you know, he's just a bandit. He's neither of these things. And I wanted him like going in between these disguises. And one day he's a Talib, the next day he's a soldier, the next day he's a thief, the next mm-hmm. day he's a Sufi mm-hmm. imam, the next day he's a woman in a burqa. Mm-hmm. And I really like with Jawed in particular, like I wanted, there's certainly like there are these like archetypes of like the trickster character. And yes, I wanted. Yes. Yeah. I wanted him to do, and I wanted him to also to be like, I also wanted him to sort of reflect a lot of like Marwan's own insecurities and fears that he has about the country. Mm. And so for me, like Jawed was like a really important sort of complex character that, yeah. and I just loved writing him because I never knew what he was going to do next.
Right. Yeah, you know, through the book, you managed to, not in a heavy-handed way, but, you know, give a lot of the history, give especially like the more modern history of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
But, you know, just, I mean, an obvious fact, but just reminds you about how much, you know, like when you talk about Fanon and colonialism, about how much 20, yeah. 40, 80 years ago affects today, you know, 100 yeah, years absolutely. Ago affects today. And so, you know, you refer to the Taliban as the T
yeah.
a lot of times, right? And, you know, with the Northern Alliance and then the Mujahideen and, of course, the, you know, the Soviet invasion and a lot of people tell stories about their time and, you know, in 84 and 82 and all the way back to the British and, of course, the Americans. And we talked about some almost literal, if a ghost can be literal, the almost literal ghosts and figurative ones. Yeah. And then towards the end, you know, Marwan finds bones.
Yeah.
Right. In the cave of sorts. Right.
Yeah. And it's absolutely.
So interesting about this idea of just of history as almost like a living, breathing, you know, all it took was, I mean, it was quite a flood, but it took a flood to get, and the bones were just out, right?
So I guess that's right.
I wonder about tracing history through your book and also just, I guess, just Afghanistan as almost like a character itself.
Yeah, you know, that was, when I began writing the novel, like I knew that the history of Afghanistan, especially like the more contemporary history, but also to a certain degree, like the, you know, the older history of like the Anglo-Afghan wars and the sort of those decades of like English colonization in Afghanistan. Like I knew I wanted that to be incorporated into the novel. The problem for me then became like, how do I accomplish that with this 12-year-old character? And how do I, and you know, as you mentioned, like I didn't want it to be heavy-handed. I didn't want it to be shoehorned in. Mm-hmm. I didn't want like all of a sudden for the novel to just turn into like this history lesson, right?
Sure.
I wanted the book to be engaging with Afghan history, but I wanted that to occur in a very organic way, in a way that like benefited the story itself. And so that was a big problem for me initially. And you know, and it's funny because like the story within the story, like methodology, right? Like it helped me so much in terms of craft, in terms of like narrative momentum, but it also helped me with that problem of history as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's funny because like coming back to it, like it took me a while to sort of figure out that how to use that as a form within the story. Mm-hmm. But you know, growing up, like that's how I was introduced to the history of Afghanistan. It was literally like I would be telling a story about the communist president Najibullah and his dungeon in Kabul where people were at Hekmatyar and how he rose to infamy in Logad, or he'd be telling you about, you know, the communist commander Dostum, who when the communists started losing ends up switching sides to the Mujahideen. And so like growing up, I was just like, always given to me in the form of writing this novel. And it finally hits me like that to mm-hmm. use this form of the story within the story. Then all of a sudden, like it just became very natural, a very natural way to incorporate the history into the novel through these oral stories. I was trying to find a natural way for Marwan to find the next storyteller mm-hmm. to tell him that next story. And you know, and if it incorporated elements of Afghan history, and much of the time it did, like that was even better to the book as a whole, you know. And so you know, you'd mention for example the bones that he eventually emerged out of the earth and towards towards the end of the novel. And you know, that was rooted in all these stories that I'd grown up hearing about these massacres that had occurred in Logar, and that there were these tunnels where people were going to tunnels and canals and as shelters from the bombing. And when the Soviet forces realized that the Afghans were doing this, they began gassing these tunnels. And so my father would describe sort of these horrific scenes of these just underground tunnels and canals just filled with dead bodies. And as far as I knew, you know, when I would later in my life, when I would go to do research on these massacres, there's very little written about it, you know, because Logar is in the countryside. There weren't many journalists going there. There was very little actual official written knowledge of these historical massacres that occurred. Whereas in Kabul, there's much more recording of what actually occurred there because it's like this metropolitan city. Sure. And so for me, you know, one of the most important tasks of the novel itself, as much as it's about Marwan, as much as it's about the family, and as much as it's about the search for the dog, like, it was also very, very important for me that I didn't let this particular element of the history of Logar, I didn't want it to die. I didn't want it to be lost to history. And so here it is in the novel, sort of bursting out of the earth itself.
The book was highly lauded. Got like Jesmyn Ward, like a book club type of thing.
Yeah, that was very nice.
Oh my gosh. You know, the great, speaking of, what was the name of her book? I think it had bones in the title, didn't it?
Salvage the Bones.
Salvage the Bones. There you go. All right. Salvage the Bones. Yeah. Wow. So many great compliments. Yeah. I mean, you managed to do so much. You talked about how you got the history through with a 12-year-old narrator, and it was seamless. It really was. You're not done yet, though. You've got you've got the collection coming out in July. There was a story called Occupational Hazards, which is published in not the Sacramento Bee, not the Reno Gazette. Oh, the New Yorker. Yeah, kind of a big deal, right? Kind of a big deal.
It means a lot.
How much of that was like it's in the form of a resume.
That's right.
That a father, which in some of the interviews, I think you said was pretty much your father.
Yeah.
How much of this is kind of like a love letter to your dad, I guess, and the amount of jobs, the type of jobs, the things that he went through, that this main character went through, are just almost mind-boggling. You said that you even kind of toned it down a little bit, I think.
Yeah, you know, there was a whole like section of my father's life where he spent like 2 years in Iran. And he was working on a landowner's like grape vineyard in Iran, and he ended up saving like the landowner's daughter's life from like this guy that was trying to kill her because she wasn't marrying him. And then he almost had this chance to like marry this landowner's daughter in Iran and start this whole other life, but he had to go back to Afghanistan because of the war. And so that was a whole section I had to completely cut out because it was just too much. I would say like a love letter to my dad is, I think, like a pretty good description of the story, which is kind of funny because it's written in the form of a resume, which is like the most loveless thing probably come up with. Totally. And so, but yeah, you know, like I've been doing for 99 Nights in Logar, and then, you know, for this upcoming novel I'm working on, like I've been doing a lot of research on Afghanistan, but then also like research on my own family and my father. And so I've been doing these interviews with my dad. It was really astounding to me how much of his life was just like going from like one form of labor to the next. Right. And so, you know, my dad, like in my eyes, like he's always been like the most hardworking guy in existence. Like, you know, he's quite literally like, you know, it's like he broke down his body, for his family, to keep us fed, to keep us clothed, to make sure we were looked after. Once I began like writing just this list of like the different jobs my dad has had, and it was like, you know, it was shepherd and it was farmer and it was mujahid and it was a road builder and it was, you know, a factory worker and it was taxi driver, not taxi driver, but newspaper delivery. Oh, yeah. And it was rug seller and like just the vastness and the degree of like the different things. And I was like, this is a story. Hell, you know, I'm just gonna write this story that's all about the different jobs my dad has taken throughout his life, and just sort of, and just see what I can do with that in terms of narrative. And in the beginning, it was very difficult because I couldn't figure out what exactly, like, what I was doing with it.
Yeah.
But eventually, of course, like, I was able to sort of figure out these through lines and yeah, you know, I owe a lot to my father and now like I wrote this story because of him as well.
Oh man. Tell us about, so it's The Haunting of Haji Hotak and Other Stories, comes out in July. What's the publisher? Do you have any favorite places, you know, people should buy your book?
Yeah, that's coming out on July 19th with Viking, same publisher as 99 Nights of Logar. You know, it's going to be my preference is always if you have a local bookstore, please, you know, support your local bookstores. There's a website. It's like I'm completely blanking on its name now.
Bookshop.org maybe.
Bookshop.org. That's a good one. Yeah. You know, because part of the proceeds go back to the local bookstores. There's also another one called like Indie.
Okay.
I'm blanking on his name, but that's a resource where you can type in the name of a book and then it'll show you all the local bookstores that have it. And so, you know, so that's another great resource. And, you know, if possible, please do try to support your local bookstore because they're really like they hold up. I think the lit industry, especially like a contemporary literary fiction. It's like we owe a lot to those local bookstores and they need our help. So please, if you can, you know, buy from your local bookstore.
No doubt. Thank you so much. I mean, you know, you're talking about I don't think you've cracked 30 yet. You've got this highly lauded book. You've got the collection coming out. I'd love to, hopefully this is not goodbye. Hopefully, you know, maybe get you in the classroom one of these years, whether virtually or in person, and you know, continue the conversation, and just wish you great luck in the future.
Hey, thanks so much. This has been really, really great conversation. You know, so yeah, I would love that.
Love talking to you. Thank you so much.
You have a good one.
What a pleasure it's been today to speak to Jamil John Kochai. Continue good luck to him with his writing, and I'm so looking forward to continuing to follow his career. You can now subscribe to the Chills of Will podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for it by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. You can watch this and other episodes on YouTube at the Chills at Will Podcast channel. Please subscribe to both my YouTube channel and my podcast while you're checking out this episode. Did you enjoy this episode? I hope you did. Please, tell a friend, tell 7. Subscribe, retweet, please. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills Will podcast is Wind Down instrumental version, and the other song played on this episode is Hoops instrumental by Matt Whitehour. Both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for episode 126 with Kevin Owens, a veteran of overseas professional basketball and a current teacher and basketball coach. He is an entrepreneur and founder of Overseas Famous LLC, a multimedia platform created to give athletes playing abroad a voice. These stories provide a behind-the-scenes look at what goes on with overseas sports. Kevin's 2021 book is called, you guessed it, Overseas Famous. While he had the name first, he is now the second most popular Kevin Owens in the world. This episode will air on June 7th. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Jamil John Kochai, whose works, like 99 Nights in Logar, and The Haunting of Haji Hotak and Other Stories give you chills at will.